Hello, friend. I need to tell you about a book that had me completely locked in. It's called Run on Red by Noel W. Eiley. Picture this, a dark, empty highway through the Idaho hills. No cell signal for miles. Two women realize the headlights behind them aren't going away. What starts as road rage turns into something far worse, a brutal, heart-pounding fight for survival that doesn't let up for a single page. Laura and Olivia can't outrun what's coming, so they have to fight back. And this book does what the best thrillers do. It takes an ordinary situation and makes you realize how fast it can go sideways. I burned through it. Every chapter drops you off a cliff. If you're into Freda McFadden or Karen Slaughter, this is your next read. Run on Red is now available as a deluxe special edition with gorgeous stenciled edges, as beautiful on the shelf as it is terrifying in your hands. Out February 24th. Grab it while you can. The galley was packed to suffocation. July 21st, 1865. Every seat in the Devizes Assize Court had been claimed hours before dawn. 5 years they'd waited for this moment. 5 years since 3-year-old Francis Saville Kent was found with his throat cut in the family privy. 5 years since Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher accused Constance Kent of murdering her baby brother and was destroyed for saying so. Now the gallery got what they came for. Constance stood in the prisoner's dock, 21 years old, wearing deep mourning black, her face pale and composed beneath the courtroom's gas lamps. Her defense counsel, John Duke Coolidge, had prepared an elaborate argument, moral insanity, the kind that gripped young women under terrible strain. It would have spared her life, an asylum rather than the gallows. But Constance Kent had other plans. When the clerk asked how she pleaded to the murder of Francis Saville Kent, Constance Emily Kent spoke one word: guilty. No mitigation, no excuse, no insanity defense that might have saved her from the rope. Just one word that silenced the entire gallery. Justice Wills, a man known for both severity and surprising mercy, asked repeatedly if she understood what she was saying. She did. Asked if anyone had coerced her confession. No one had. He pressed her for her motive, offered jealousy as the obvious reason a girl might murder her favored younger brother. And here Constance interrupted him, faintly but clearly, not jealousy, then said nothing more. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is the story of the trial that lasted 30 minutes, the death sentence that wasn't carried out, and the extraordinary second life of England's most notorious murderess.
Within days of the verdict, the Home Secretary acted. Constance Kent's death sentence was commuted to penal servitude for life. The reasoning was straightforward. She had been 16 years old at the time of the murder, legally still a child herself. She had carried the secret for 5 years, presumably in torment. She had confessed voluntarily, surrendered herself to authorities when no one suspected her anymore. These facts, combined with Justice Will's recommendation, spared her the gallows. But public opinion was far from unanimous. Those who wanted execution made their case in letters to newspapers and sermons from pulpits. A 3-year-old child had been lifted from his bed in the night, carried to an outdoor privy, and slaughtered. His throat cut so deeply his head nearly separated from his body. What clemency did such a crime deserve? Francis Saville Kent was dead. Why should his murderer live? others accepted the commutation. Constance had been a girl of 16, traumatised by her own family's dysfunction. She had confessed when she could have remained silent forever, free to live her life unburdened by suspicion. Life imprisonment was hardly mercy. It could mean 40 years in Victorian prison conditions. Death by inches rather than the quick drop of the gallows. For Inspector Jonathan Witcher, vindication came wrapped in bitterness. The newspapers that had called him vulgar and rapacious in 1860 now quietly acknowledged he had been right all along. Every instinct, every deduction, every piece of circumstantial evidence he had assembled, all of it correct. The missing nightgown. Constance's opportunity, her motive rooted in family trauma. But Witcher had left Scotland Yard the previous year, his career in ruins, his health broken by the scandal. The vindication came 5 years too late to restore what the Roadhill House case had destroyed. For 20 years, Constance Kent lived within prison walls, first at Millbank, the forbidding Riverside Penitentiary in Westminster, later at Fulham Refuge, a somewhat less severe facility for women, showing signs of reform. Victorian prisons operated on principles of penitence and labour. Inmates spent their days in silence. Speaking was forbidden except during specified hours. Work was mandatory. Constance laboured in kitchens and laundries, the same menial tasks performed by servants, in the household she had once inhabited as a daughter of the middle class. Religious services were compulsory, continuing the Anglo-Catholic influence that had led to her confession. She was, by every account, a model prisoner. No disciplinary reports. No incidents of violence or defiance. 20 years of silent compliance, religious observance and hard labour. Prison officials described her as genuinely penitent, not merely performing reform for parole consideration, but apparently transformed by her time inside. She educated herself extensively, reading whatever books the prison library provided. She learned the principles of nursing, skills that would define her second life, and she waited. In 1885, after 2 decades behind bars, the question of release arose. Constance Kent was 41 years old. She had entered prison as a young woman and would leave it in middle age. The Home Office approved her release on one condition. She must leave England. The Roadhill House murderess could not walk free in the country where Francis Savile Kent's death still haunted public memory. She chose Australia. Her brother William Savile Kent had emigrated the previous year in 1884. Whether this was coordination or coincidence remains unknown, but in early 1886, a woman named Ruth Amelia Kay boarded the ship Carisbrook Castle bound for Sydney. Constance Emily Kent had ceased to exist.
When Ruth Emily Kay stepped off the Carisbrook Castle onto Sydney's dock in February 1886, Constance Kent ceased to exist. No one in Australia knew that this plain-faced middle-aged woman had spent the last 20 years in English prisons. No one knew that she had, at 16, murdered a 3-year-old boy while he slept. No one knew anything at all. She would keep it that way for 58 years. Ruth Emily Kay sought nursing training, a respectable profession for a single woman in the wake of Florence Nightingale's reforms. She proved capable, dedicated, and utterly unremarkable. She worked in hospitals throughout Sydney and beyond, eventually rising to the position of matron at several institutions. She specialized in caring for the elderly and infirm, the vulnerable populations that required patience and compassion. Her colleagues found her competent, but distant. She never married. She had no close friends. She attended Anglican services regularly, but revealed nothing of her spiritual history. When asked about England, about her past, about why a well-spoken woman with traces of an English accent, was nursing in the colonies. She offered nothing. Her brother William had arrived in Australia a year before her. Whether this was coordination or coincidence has never been established. William became a distinguished marine biologist, his career taking him across Australia and beyond. If the siblings who had once been so close, who had run away together as children, who may have shared knowledge of Francis's murder, ever reunited, no record survives. William Saville Kent died in 1908 at his home in Bournemouth, England. He had returned to the country they both had fled. Constance would have been 63 years old. There is no evidence she attended his funeral, mourned publicly, or acknowledged his passing in any way. Whatever bond had existed between them, whatever secrets they shared, went with William to his grave. And Constance went on, nursing the sick and elderly of New South Wales, her identity protected by an ocean and a half century of silence. While Ruth Emily Kay nursed the sick in Sydney, back in England, the Roadhill House murder took on a different kind of life. What began as Victorian scandal was becoming something more enduring. The foundation of an entire literary genre. In 1868, 3 years after Constance's trial, the novelist Wilkie Collins published The Moonstone. The poet T.S. Eliot would later call it the first, the longest, and the best of modern English detective novels. It was also, unmistakably, the Roadhill House murder transformed into fiction. Collins' detective, Sergeant Cuff, was Witcher in all but name. A working-class investigator called to a country house, suspecting someone of higher social standing, brilliant and methodical, but ultimately thwarted by class prejudice. The missing nightgown became a missing diamond. The respectable family hiding secrets, the incompetent local police, the detective from London piecing together what everyone else missed. All of it drawn from the case that had gripped England. Collins established the template that would define detective fiction for the next century and a half.
Every trope we now take for granted in detective fiction traces back to Roadhill House. The country house mystery, an affluent family, murder at home, everyone with motive, secrets within secrets, the detective and outsider who sees through social facades. The structure itself came from Witcher's investigation, incompetent local authorities, the brilliant specialist called in, red herrings and false leads, the unexpected culprit, the solution based on psychology and evidence rather than luck. Arthur Conan Doyle read Collins and created Sherlock Holmes, the detective as intellectual, solving impossible crimes through observation and deduction. Agatha Christie built a career on country house mysteries, where respectable families harboured murderers. Dorothy Sayers' 1926 novel Clouds of Witness echoed elements of the Roadhill House case. Every fictional detective who ever followed clues to an unexpected culprit owes something to the case that made detection itself seem possible.
Inspector Witcher never lived to see the full flowering of the genre he had helped inspire. He died on June 29, 1881, exactly 21 years after the night Francis Saville Kent was murdered. The coincidence was remarkable enough that newspapers noted it. Witcher had spent his final years in a quiet house in Lavender Hill, tending roses in his garden, just as Sergeant Cuff would do in The Moonstone. He never married. He left no children. His obituaries were respectful but brief, mentioning that unfortunate Roadhill House case as if it had been a failure rather than the investigation that proved correct in every detail. He was right about Constance Kent from the first day he arrived at Roadhill House. It cost him everything. Ruth Emily Kay retired from nursing in 1932, at the age of 87. She had served as matron at Parramatta Industrial School for Girls, a juvenile detention facility, for 11 years, and then at Pierce Memorial Nurses Home in East Maitland for 21 more. Over 4 decades of caring for others, building a career of service from the ashes of what she had destroyed. She settled in a rest home in Strathfield, a quiet Sydney suburb. The Second World War raged across the Pacific, but Ruth Emily Kay was beyond such concerns. She was approaching her centenary, an elderly woman with kind eyes who had once been a 16-year-old girl with a razor in her hand. On April 10, 1944, Ruth Emily Kay died. She was 100 years old. The next day, she was cremated at Rookwood Cemetery. A brief notice appeared in the Sydney newspapers. Ruth Emily Kay, nurse, age 100, formerly of England. Nothing more. No one in Australia knew they were burying Constance Kent, the Roadhill House murderess who had confessed to slaughtering her 3-year-old brother 84 years earlier. 100 years of life, 84 years since the murder, 58 years in Australia as someone else entirely, and in the end, just a name in a Sydney obituary, a life of service to the sick, and secrets she took to her ashes. More than 160 years after that June night in 1860, the Roadhill House murder still haunts us. Not because we don't know who did it. We do. Constance Kent confessed, served her time, lived her second life, and died at 100 years old on the far side of the world. But what haunts us are the questions we will never answer. Did William help her that night? Did the brother she loved so fiercely, the only ally she had in that fractured household, share in the planning, the execution, the guilt? Historian Kate Summerscale's research suggests he may have. Constance's repeated insistence that she acted alone and unaided sounds to modern ears like someone protesting too much. Both siblings ended up in Australia. Both kept their distance from each other. Both took their secrets to their graves. What was her true motive? Not jealousy, she insisted at trial. But if not jealousy of Francis, then what? Revenge against her father for the affair, the remarriage, the favoritism? Rage at a stepmother who had replaced her own mother and then denied her love? Francis was not her enemy. He was 3 years old, innocent of everything except the accident of his birth. He was a symbol, and she destroyed him. How did she live with it? That is the mystery that may matter most. 84 years from the murder to her death, 20 years in prison, then 58 years as Ruth Emily Kay, nursing the sick, caring for the elderly, living a useful, quiet life. Did religious transformation bring genuine peace? Did service to others provide some kind of penance? Or did she simply lock away Constance Kent in some mental room and live as Ruth Emily Kay, a different woman entirely? We will never know. Some mysteries stay mysteries. But we can remember Frances Saville Kent, not as the victim, not as a plot device in a Victorian murder mystery, but as a 3-year-old boy with dark hair and bright eyes, who woke each morning in his nursery to the sounds of his family stirring around him, who ate his porridge at a small table by the window while watching the gardeners work below, who played in the June sunshine of a Wiltshire garden, not knowing those would be his last days, whose small voice calling for Elizabeth, reaching for his mother, asking for one more story before bed, fell silent on a night that would echo through a century and a half of English history. He was not the mystery. He was the cost. And we can remember Inspector Jonathan Witcher, the first modern detective, the working-class investigator who saw the truth when everyone else around him refused to see it. He was right about Constance Kent from the moment he had arrived at Roadhill House. It cost him his career, his health, his reputation. Vindication came 5 years too late. But every detective story ever written, from Sergeant Cuff to Sherlock Holmes, to Hercule Poirot, owes something to the man who stood in that Wiltshire garden and knew a 16-year-old girl had murdered her brother. Their stories deserve to be told. All of their stories. Until next time, remember, the Roadhill House murder gave us modern detective fiction, but it took more than it gave. A 3-year-old boy who never grew up, a detective who was right too early to be believed, a family shattered beyond repair, and a woman who lived 100 years with the weight of what she had done at 16. Some crimes changed the world. This one changed how we tell stories about crime itself. Thanks for listening, friend.